All right, Tuesday night Bible study on the Gospel of John. We're going to finish chapter 8 today, finally, hooray. It was a long chapter, so that's okay. But, so our third week now on chapter 8 in John. So, last week we did the middle part of the chapter, and Jesus is in kind of a debate, or almost an argument, with the Jews. They're talking about... they start out, we talked about way back here, let me scroll up on the screen. They say, you can't testify about yourself. That's not proper. It's kind of not a legal principle. And he says, well, I don't testify about me. The Father testifies about me. Well, that introduces the topic of Father. And then Jesus goes on to say, well, part of the reason you don't understand is because you're slaves. They say, no, we're not. Our father is Abraham. So we're not slaves. We've never been slaves to anyone. And of course, there's some irony there, isn't there? Because the Hebrews were slaves in Egypt. So first of all, they're kind of neglecting or purposely forgetting their own history. But that's not even what Jesus was talking about. And he goes on to say that he's talking about being slaves to sin. And right there in verse 34... truly I say to you, everyone who practices sin is a slave to sin. And then that's kind of where we ended last week, at verse 38. Okay? Sound a little bit familiar? We'll forge ahead. Verse 39. They answered him. So they're kind of reiterating here. They answered him, Abraham is our father. So they're reiterating the same thing again, because the topic of Abraham came up, and the topic of slavery came up, and so they're again pointing back to their ancestry from Abraham, who was a free man, was a slave to no one. Jesus said to them, if you were Abraham's children, you would be doing the works Abraham did. But now you seek to kill me, a man who has told you the truth that I heard from God. This is not what Abraham did. So what does he mean, Jesus? What does Jesus mean? If you were Abraham's children, you would be doing the works Abraham did. There's a couple of places where Abraham is used as an example. Paul does it in Romans, and I think it's in Hebrews also. What are the works that Abraham did that are most well known, or Abraham is most praised for?
Trusting in God.
Yeah, trusting in God. God gave him a promise, he trusted God, and it was counted as righteousness. That's what Paul says in Romans, I think. So that's the work. So that sometimes that word work gets some people kind of hung up a little bit. Because is trusting in God a work? No. We would say no.
But there's evidence of things he actually did that show his trust, like the Isaac situation.
Sure. Absolutely. There are things he did, but they were showing the trust and the faith that he had. Exactly right. Yep. All right. So that was his greatest work. And actually, Genesis 15:6, I put that down in my notes. I think that's where God promised him that his descendants would be as numerous as the stars of the sky, the sand of the seashore, and Abraham believed him. That's what it says back in Genesis 15. So that's right where you see it, kind of at the beginning of Abraham's call. Right from the beginning. Abraham did a number of things that showed his faith and trust in God, but from the beginning, he trusted God. That's impressive. And so then in verse 40, had Abraham tried to kill anyone? There's a little secondary hint here at verse 40. You seek to kill me. What did Abraham do when he had three apparent strangers approach him, although he knew they were angels, or at least he came to know eventually that they were angels? What did Abraham do?
He invited them in.
He went and killed a goat or a lamb to serve them a little meal, had some bread made, sat and attended to them while they rested under the shade. I mean, that's hospitality. That's part of that culture, so that's part of it. But also, he welcomed them in, and at some point, he came to realize they were angels. That's not what they're doing here, is it? They're attacking Jesus. They're seeking to kill him, and Jesus knows that. You seek to kill me, a man who has told you the truth that I heard from God. This is not what Abraham did. And then Jesus says, you are doing the works your father did. Ooh. said, Abraham's their father. Now, Jesus is refuting that somewhat plainly here. He's not speaking in, you know, vague terms like he often does. That's not what Abraham did. You were doing the works of your father. So if you're one of the Jewish leaders, the Pharisees, Sadducees, and you hear this, what are you thinking? Well, he's denigrating our ancestry. He's claiming we're not from Abraham. He's claiming we have someone else for our father. I would suspect, now this is just a little bit of speculation on my part, that they don't yet realize Jesus is referring to the devil as their father. They don't quite yet know that. Jesus is about to say that even more plainly. So they're just thinking Jesus is criticizing their ancestry here, that they're not really sons of Abraham. So what do they say? The end of verse 41. They said to him, "We were not born of sexual immorality. We have one father, even God." Now, what does that mean, born of sexual immorality?
Well, if they knew that Jesus' mother was pregnant and they weren't married, then they were throwing that out.
Exactly right. It was a dig at Jesus. So they felt Jesus was impugning them, so they turn around and insult him by saying, well, we weren't the ones that were born out of sexual immorality. So obviously there was some awareness and knowledge that Mary was pregnant before she was married. And so they're accusing him of being, well, what would the polite word be? Illegitimate? But, you know, we don't really say that nowadays. And actually, even though I'm not one for, you know, politically correct terms, I would agree we shouldn't use that term. Because children are never illegitimate. They're born maybe into unfortunate circumstances, you know, a single mother out of wedlock or something. That doesn't mean the child is illegitimate. And I probably wouldn't use that other word either. So what do you say? How do you refer to somebody like that? I don't know. Anyway, so they're kind of insulting Jesus back. And then they raise their own level of ancestry above Abraham. We have one father, God. So they're pointing themselves right to God. All right.
You could use that word. They use it in the study Bible.
Yeah, it's right there in the study Bible.
What word?
Bastard
child. Bastard?
Yeah.
I was trying to not use that word.
I'm just reading it.
Yeah, it's in the study Bible.
Yeah.
All right.
There was a time not so long ago when the worst thing you could say to somebody was to insult their parents.
Mm-hmm. Sure.
Son of a...
Yeah, right.
The joke of it later on in the 60s was your mother wears combat boots.
Yeah.
But that was the highest thing. It was the hardest thing for my father when I became Lutheran was that. He felt like I was turning my face on Mary.
Uh-huh.
And how can you not honor a parent?
Uh-huh.
If you know, because he grew up with that very strong.
Yeah.
That, and this... It would be a real insult to someone. The worst thing you could tell them would be that their mother was...
Right.
Yeah.
You know, that's an interesting observation, because you're right. I thinking just back to movies or, frankly, cartoons, you know, Bugs Bunny and whatever, born out of the 60s and 70s and all of that. Yes, to insult somebody's parents or mother or family in general, that was a big insult. Yeah, that seems to, you know, the level of insults in modern culture seems to have shifted.
Yeah.
It's different now than it was
we're
then.
We're more eye-centered in America.
Yeah.
I'm sure in some countries,
yeah.
They would still protect their family's honor.
Right.
To hear about it.
Right.
Is,
yeah.
There's even grammatical differences that you refer to in Spanish.
Yeah.
That still exists today. You don't say a certain you pronoun with mother.
Okay.
Because it's considered a giant insult.
Sure. Yeah, there seems to be a lot less concern about honor in American culture today, doesn't there? And honor of your family as well, to protect your family's honor. It's unfortunate. It shouldn't be that way.
I'm reading through Numbers, and they counted every male who went out into the desert. So every person, it was a big deal to be on that ancestry list.
Mm-hmm.
And I think it is even modern in modern Israel, because in order to be be a citizen, you have to prove that you're a descendant.
Is that true? I didn't know that.
In order, you know, the African nations have had a particular struggle with this, the Moroccans.
Okay.
And the Sudanese.
Of showing ancestry to become an Israeli citizen?
The diaspora who want to come back.
Oh, I see.
And live in Israel
okay.
have to prove their ancestry.
Now, do they have a case, do you happen to know in Israel, if you're born in Israel, are you a citizen? Or you still have to show ancestry to some Jewish roots? I don't know.
We're one of the only countries that has, if you're born here, you're a citizen.
Oh, really? So that's uncommon around the world in other nations.
It was for slavery.
Okay.
Make sure they were citizens.
Okay.
So if you wanted to be saved with the Jewish nation, you had to prove your ancestry, and that's why.
Well,
so important.
Sure. Well, ancestry, and all of you know, when if you're reading through the Bible or read the Bible in a year, or in my case, 2 years, you get to those genealogies, and they're even in the beginning of the Gospels. And you say, oh, this is boring. Why does it matter? And if you're like me, you kind of skim through. Oh, there's a name I know. Okay, now I can go on and read. Right? Sorry. Maybe I shouldn't admit that to you as a pastor, but I do. I skim those. Ancestry was a big deal. For one main reason was to track the line of the Messiah, of course. But also so that they knew they belonged. It gave them an identity, and they were part of God's chosen people. Well, we have an ancestry, too, that we can all trace back to our birth, our spiritual birth, right? Our baptism. You trace back to your baptism, and you are born into the family of God. And so it's interesting. You shall not take the name of the Lord your God in vain. Well, it's because we don't want to impugn God's honor. So we're protecting our spiritual family's honor, that of God. Well, this is an interesting little kind of extemporaneous devotion here that we're just kind of talking about. Thank you for bringing up the whole topic, Terry. That's interesting to ponder that a little bit. Yeah, Rich?
Genealogy list. You're sitting here making a comment there about kind of skimming through them. Actually, you could probably treat them more like a dictionary than you do reading material, because when you study the Bible and this name comes up, you can go and find it in the genealogy of Jesus.
Sure. You can do that.
Instead
you're right.
You're reading that and trying to get something out of it just by reading that particular
paragraph. Yeah, there you go.
Paragraph.
Well, thank you for justifying me. All right, so where were we? We were not born of sexual immorality. We have one Father, even God. Jesus said to them, "If God were your Father, you would love me, for I came from God, and I am here. I came not of my own accord, but he sent me." So he is saying, if that's true, you would recognize who I am. And why would he say that? Why would he say, if you are truly of God, if God is your Father, you would recognize me and believe me? Because what does the Old Testament point to?
The coming of Jesus.
The coming of Jesus, the Messiah. So if you really truly understand the Old Testament, you're going to understand that Jesus is the Messiah. So he's kind of calling them out on that. And by the way, I did look it up because John is so chock full of ego I me statements. I am. You know, the translation of Yahweh, we've talked about it. We've got a lot more of those occurrences coming up. This is not one of them. Right here in verse 42. I looked it up in my Greek New Testament. For I came from God and I am here. It is not I am. It's different. Actually, did I put it in my notes? I don't think I did. So it's not ego I me. In fact, I think it's just I me. So it would be, for I came from God and am here. No I. Really, I suppose, would be maybe a little more literal translation. Came not of my own accord, but he sent me. Verse 43, why do you not understand what I say? It is because you cannot bear to hear my word. You cannot bear to hear my word. So their minds are closed. Have you ever tried to talk to somebody who is so set in their own thinking or in their own approach or in their own opinion about something, or maybe they're in an emotional state, you just can't explain anything to them. There's nothing that is sinking in. You ever been try to talk to somebody in that situation?
We're a bunch of German Lutherans.
We are that situation, right?
We are that situation.
Yeah, that is very true. Yeah, good observation. Yeah, Jill can't tell me a thing.
It's kind of like in Jeremiah when they come to him and say, they want to go to Egypt, and they say, well, ask God what we should do, and we'll do it. And then he tells them, well, God says to stay here. And I said, no, he didn't.
Yeah. I can think of a few cases in my life where, one before I became a pastor, I was in the working world, and there was one of my co-workers who was so upset because something had happened, and our supervisor had mismanaged something and given her some bad information. And she was just emotional as can be. And I happened to be the one to pick up the phone because he wasn't at his desk. And I tried to explain to her, well, you know, I was trying to explain in the kindest way, and it wasn't at me. She was just so upset, I just finally shut up and just let her talk. And finally she got it out and it kind of died down, and then I said, you know, you should come in and talk to him if you're mad at him for something, you know, figure it out. You know, that was kind of in my pre-pastor days. And I realized as a pastor, there have been times where somebody comes in and they're so upset or so emotional about something, there's nothing I can say. It's best to just let them go on and kind of get it out, vent, if you will. Well, that's not the case quite here. Jesus is not letting them vent. But they're so set in their ways. They're so certain that their opinion is right. Yeah, I am describing German Lutherans, aren't I? there's nothing you can say to them. Why do you not understand what I say? It is because you cannot bear to hear my word. You guys have heard that joke, haven't you, about changing a light bulb?
Which one?
Yeah.
How many Lutherans does it take to change a light bulb?
Change.
He's heard it. Change? We don't change. Yeah. There's the whole long joke about how many Methodists it takes to change a light bulb. Well, first they got to form a committee. And how many Catholics does it take to change a light bulb? Well, they got to ask the Pope. You know, this kind of stuff. Then you get to the Lutherans and it's change? All right. Sorry. Anyway, it's rare that a joke pops into my head. I don't have a sense of humor you do, Phil. All right. So here, now, in verse 44, he is about to speak very plainly. You are of your father the devil, and your will is to do your father's desires. He was a murderer from the beginning and does not stand in the truth, because there is no truth in him. When he lies, he speaks out of his character, for he is a liar and the father of lies. Wow. There's no ambiguity there, no vagueness. Jesus finally comes out and says it. He's been hinting at it now for two paragraphs. And he finally says, you're of your father, the devil. That's truly who your father is. Now, what is the devil known for? What does his name mean? And why is Jesus referring to him this way? Well, the two main things the devil is known for is being a murderer and being a liar. Those are his core characteristics of his nature. What's the core characteristic of God's nature? Just as a slight aside, perhaps you guys remember, and it's from John in his epistles. God is
love.
The core nature of God is love. And that defines everything. The core nature of the devil is a murderer and a liar. So Jesus is giving us some insight on the devil here. But then he's also attaching the Jewish leaders, the Pharisees, to the devil. Boy, do you think that's going to get them enraged? Absolutely, it's going to get them enraged. This is the truth. You are of the devil because you are opposing the truth. You are refusing the truth. You are dwelling in lies. Now, as a slight aside, but it's not too much of an aside, I want to read for you half a paragraph about the devil from this verse, from the commentary that I'm generally using, from Dr. Weinrich. I had him, by the way, very hard professor. this is what he says. At the beginning, the devil opposed the intent of God to place man in the world as his image and as that creature in whom God himself would be present in and for the world. The devil, then, does not merely tempt man to sin. He tempts man to cease being man, the image of God's own nature. Satan wars against God by bringing man under his sway. Sinful man, as it were, hides from God from the world and renders him unknown and the object of disbelief and blasphemy. I'd never heard that before. I thought that was a great insight there. So the devil isn't merely tempting us to sin. That is part of what he does. But God intended man to be God's representation in creation. What is one of our tasks in creation? To have dominion over the earth, right? To care for, to provide for, to be a caretaker, to be gardeners. Any of you gardeners? That's a godly task, right? So the devil, he's not like that. The devil wants to be God, wants to be like God, wants to be in the place of God. And so he doesn't like that mankind is God's representative in creation. So that's part of his purpose. It's not merely to get us to sin, but to remove us from being God's representation in creation. I've never heard that before.
That's kind of like your sermon, though. You're talking about Adam and Eve, and they were already in the image of God when Satan was tempting them. Wasn't that you that...
Yeah, I did say that. You know, I did say that, yes.
When he was tempting them to say, hey, do you want to be like God? And you were saying that they were already like God as much as they could be.
Yeah, that exactly. Now, I was meaning something different. I'm not going to take credit for that. But yeah, right, that is a little connected to that quote from Dr. Weinrich. Absolutely right. So anyway, I thought that was an interesting observation. So Satan's intent, really, is to murder mankind. So he's a liar and a murderer. So that's what Jesus is talking about here. He is a liar and the father of lies. You realize God cannot lie? If somebody ever asks you that stupid, atheist puzzling question, well, can God make a rock so big that he can't lift it? Then there's no answer to that, by the way. Oh, then there's something God can't do. Yeah, actually, there's a lot of things God can't do. He can't lie. He can't not love you. There are things God can't do.
This also tells us, answers the question of where evil comes from. It's Satan is the father of lies.
Yeah.
He, as God is the father of creation, Satan is the father of lies. So that answers that.
That's a great point as well. Satan is the origin.
Yeah,
the beginning. Absolutely.
The creator of lies.
Yeah, creator of lies, yeah. God created earth and everything in it. He created mankind. He created woman as the pinnacle of mankind. And then what did the devil create? The devil created lies.
Yeah, the father of lies.
Yeah, good point, Glenn. All right, verse 45. But because I tell the truth, you do not believe me. Which one of you convicts me of sin? If I tell the truth, why do you not believe me? So there, right there in verse 45 to 46, he's basically challenging them. What have I said that's a lie? Jesus is saying. Which of you convicts me of sin, of not telling the truth? So he's kind of throwing down the gauntlet there to them to say, everything I've said is true. And yet, since you don't believe me, you're clinging to lies, therefore you are of your father, the devil. All right. Verse 47. Whoever is of God hears the words of God. The reason why you do not hear them is that you are not of God. You are not of God. Well, if you're not of God, there's only one other option. You are of whom?
Devil.
The devil. Satan. Right. Absolutely. The reason why you do not hear them is that you are not of God. So, this reminds me that we can't understand or listen to God or hold on to his words in faith unless we are of God. Actually, this is coming up in a sermon I just finished writing. So you're going to hear more about it. Little preview. We can't be of God unless God makes us of God. Right? And when does God do that? Your baptism. Exactly right. Back to baptism. You know, Martin Luther once said that he could preach every sermon in his entire career as a pastor about baptism and never exhaust all of the wonderful benefits and blessings that God gives in baptism.
I can't believe you said that.
Yeah, well, he said a lot of things, but that is one he said, yeah. And for me, sometimes I'm still like, I don't know, after about the third or fourth sermon on baptism, I think people would start getting bored.
Martin Luther said it. His congregants didn't say it.
Yeah, that's right. They might say, okay, Martin, Pastor Luther, you know, preach about the Lord's Supper or, you know, the fall of man in sin or something else. And we're, enough of that baptism for a while.
I don't think you could tell him that.
You couldn't tell him anything. He was a German Lutheran. Yeah.
He's the father of big-headed Lutherans.
Yeah, that's right. All right, of which I am one. All right, verse 48. Moving on, last paragraph here, although it's a bit of a longer one. The Jews answered him, "Are we not right in saying you are a Samaritan and have a demon?" So now Jesus has called them of the devil. Their father is the devil. So again, they're upping the insults again, or returning insult for what they perceive as an insult. Jesus is just telling the truth. Now he's gotten to be more blunt here in this conversation. Normally he's a little more vague and a little more finesse. Now he's gotten blunt. You're of your father, the devil, and he's the father of liars. So they're really mad. Are we not right in saying that you are a Samaritan and have a demon? Why is that an insult?
Well, I think it's interesting because it's like they don't have an answer for him, so they're just going to like name call him because they don't know what to say to him.
How often does that happen in culture today, right? Somebody doesn't have an answer for a statement or an opinion you have, so they start calling you names. Yeah, that's what's happening here. You're right. You're a Samaritan and have a demon. Why is that an insult, calling him a Samaritan?
Because they were low class. They were considered low class people.
That's part of it. The Jews and the Samaritans, everybody knows, did not like each other. Why did the Jews, it really originated with the Jews. Why did the Jews not like the Samaritans? Do you remember the history of the Samaritans, anybody?
Well, they didn't worship in Jerusalem, and they didn't keep all the high rules. I won't call them laws, rules.
Sure. They didn't follow the Pharisees' teaching. You know, they didn't acquiesce to the Sadducees' leadership in the temple. All of that, yep. Where did the Sadducees come from? What's their source? What's their origin?
Priests in the temple.
Well, what happened was, when the Hebrews were taken into captivity in Babylon, Nebuchadnezzar took the cream of the crop, all of the best, all those who were smart, who were able-bodied, who were able to work. He took, you know, the top, whatever percentage, 30, you know, 80%, I don't know, 70%, left behind those who he didn't feel, that the Babylonians didn't feel were valuable to them as workers or slaves or advisors or for whatever reason. The people left behind intermarried with the non-Jewish people around them. And that's the source of the Samaritans. So the Samaritans were considered by the Jews. They were shunned by the Jews upon returning from Babylon 70 years later, or 40 years, 40, 70. When the Jews returned, they shunned the Samaritans because they were not pure anymore. And God had forbidden them from intermixing and intermarrying with the surrounding tribes, the Edomites, the Moabites, you know, the Egyptians, all the rest, all around them. And the Samaritans were mudbloods. Yeah, mudbloods, if you're a Harry Potter fan. And so that's from the Harry Potter lore, that means you're half magical and half normal. What's the opposite? A mudbloods. Half magical and half muggle. That's how the Jews viewed the Samaritans. Half Jewish and half pagan. Okay? Or Gentile, I guess would be their word. Half Jewish and half Gentile. So that's why the Jews hated the Samaritans. The Samaritans hated the Jews back. So I would really say it kind of started with the Jews upon returning from Babylon. So what did they just accuse Jesus of his ancestry?
Half-blood.
Yeah, he was born out of immorality. This is connected to that. Not only are you born out of immorality, but you're only half a Jew, Jesus. You're only half a Jew. How can you, you must be a Samaritan, and you have a demon. So they're him of having demons. That's, you know, I almost feel like this is a couple of boys on in the sandbox saying, no, you're ugly. No, you're ugly. No, you're ugly. You know, something like that. They're accusing each other of the same thing. In Jesus' case, he's just telling the truth. Jesus answered, I do not have a demon, but I honor my Father, and you dishonor me. There's that term honor, Terry. I didn't even pick up on that, but there you go. We need to honor God. Jesus is honoring God the Father. And we honor each other as children of God, as the family of God. So he's saying he honors God the Father by doing what? Communicating God's truth. How do you dishonor somebody? By not communicating the truth about them. If one of my kids were to start telling some friends of theirs something that I didn't say and something that I wouldn't say, I would be embarrassed and probably I'd chastise them and I'd have to correct the record because, no, I didn't say that. That would be a dishonor to somebody, right? None of my kids have done that. I'm making up a fanciful situation. Okay. So, yes, we hear about that too in the catechism. We honor God by living according to his word. Right? Yes. So Jesus is doing that, and they are dishonoring him by doing what? By accusing him of not telling the truth. So they're dishonoring him. But in verse 50, Jesus says, yet I do not seek my own glory, there is one who seeks it, and he is the judge. Who's he referring to?
God
the Father is the one who's seeking his glory. Truly, truly, I say to you, if anyone keeps my word, he will never see death. So Jesus is again elevating the idea, the conversation here, and changing it a little bit, saying, my word is of such truth. What I say is so true that if you keep my word, you will never see death. Now, is that true? Of course it's true. Well, you know, we as Christians, we know that's true. What does it mean to keep his word? Keep his word. What does it mean to keep Jesus' word?
Believe it.
Believe it. Okay, absolutely.
Faithful.
Be faithful to it. Absolutely. Yep. Keep his word.
Love God, love your neighbor.
Love God, love your neighbor. Live out God's word? Is that part of it? I think that's part of it too. I think the biggest thing of keeping God's word is just believing it. Think of Abraham. He believed God's promise and it was counted to him as righteous. That's the biggest part of keeping his word. But I think keeping his word is also striving to live by it. Live by it each day. Alright, now, a little translation issue here. I'm going to bring this up for you. I say to you, if anyone keeps my word, he will never see death forever. That would be the proper translation. Or, he will never see death in eternity. Aionion is the word that is missing. That is in the Greek, and it means eternity or forever. So, he will never see death forever. And actually, never see death in eternity. So what is Jesus talking about? You keep my word, you will never see death in eternity. What's that a reference to?
Heaven.
And the next life, and after this earthly death. He's talking about eternal life in heaven. If you keep my word, you will not see death in eternity. In the book of Revelation, in John's vision that he wrote, so same author, Apostle John, he talks about two deaths. I think it's in Revelation chapter 21. He says, whoever believes in the Lamb will not taste the second death, but only the first death. What is the first death that we all experience?
Death.
Physical death. Earthly death. Physical death. Oh, yes, of course, unless Jesus comes again first. Okay. But those of us who believe in Jesus will not taste the second death. What is the second death?
hell.
Yeah, eternal death, like a living death. Weird statement, but to say, but yes, eternal death in hell. So that's what he's talking about. He will never see death in eternity. That would be a better translation there. Now, what does it mean, see? I pondered this for a little bit. You will not see. Remember when Lazarus, the poor man, was a beggar at the rich man's door, and the rich man ignored him, and then they both died, and Lazarus was carried to Abraham's bosom, which is a Hebrewism for heaven. And send Lazarus to cool my tongue. Was Lazarus aware of anything that was going on in that conversation in heaven? No. There's a chasm between us. None can go there to here or here to there. Lazarus was oblivious to it. I have had people say, well, Pastor, won't I be sad in heaven because some of my relatives or family members won't be there, those who have rejected God or don't believe? And my answer to them, and it's maybe not the best satisfactory answer, is you won't be aware of it. You won't even see it. Because it would cause you sadness. So you won't even know about that. You will never see death in eternity. You won't see hell. We can't see it from heaven. It's a giant chasm there. Okay? The Jews said to him, now we know that you have a demon. Abraham died. Here's the proof that we know you have a demon, not us. Here's the reason, Jesus. Abraham died. You're talking about never seeing death. Abraham died, as did the prophets. Yet you say, if anyone keeps my word, he will never taste death. And actually, I looked it up to see, did they alter the translation? And no. In the Greek, the Jews, quote it correctly. If anyone keeps my word, he will never taste death forever, or in eternity. This is an exact same quote as what Jesus makes. They quote him correctly, and they also say taste death forever. They change one word from see to taste. What's the difference between not seeing death? We just talked about it. You'll have the bliss of heaven and not even be aware that there is hell. That's a wonderful thing. What if you never taste death? What is that referring to? Taste. How is taste different than see?
One's inward, one's outward.
Well, yeah, taste is like consuming, yeah. Right? I looked those two words up. So before we go on, just another little side note here. I didn't write down the words in Greek. Sorry, Jen, you could look them up if you want.
Don't have my phone.
Yeah, oh, you don't?
No.
Does that make you feel like empty?
I only have one arm.
Oh, you only have one arm, yeah, that's right. Not having your phone is like not being able to use one of your arms.
Yeah.
Yeah. All right. I would feel that way, actually. I rely on my phone so much. See. The word see in Greek, and I didn't write down the Greek word, but it means to look at, perceive, or be aware of. So hence what I just said, when Jesus says you will never see death in eternity, you won't even be aware of death in eternity. Be aware of. Taste. This word taste can mean to taste as in eat. That is a legitimate translation. But it also means to be involved in or to experience. Aha! So you will never experience death. They changed Jesus' translation in one way, that word. Well, is it true that we will not experience death? If they're talking about earthly death, that's not true, and that's not what Jesus was saying. Because sin still exists in this existence, we will taste death. Yes, of course, unless Jesus comes again first for the last day. Okay, there's the exception. I had some confirmant kind of call me, well, Pastor, so I kind of give that exception. Yes, of course. But probably all of us will taste physical death, but we will not see eternal death. Does that make sense?
Yeah.
So first of all, before we go on with this debate and argument between Jesus and the Jews, that teaches us something. And I think that something is comforting. Yes, we have physical problems
and diseases and medical issues because of sin in the world, and eventually we will taste death, physical death, but we will not experience or be aware of eternal death. I think that's of great comfort. What?
Psalm 34, too. It's the old taste and see that the Lord is good.
Ah, yes. So taste. No, that would be in Hebrew, so I'd have to look up and see if the Hebrew word for taste has the same meaning as the Greek word for taste. But if taste means to experience, experience from Psalm 34 that the Lord is good. So there is a good connection there. Yeah, thank you. All right. So they slightly misquote Jesus in a significant way. Verse 53, are you greater than our father Abraham who died? So they're talking about death. That's the whole conversation here now in this paragraph. Are you talking about Abraham, our father Abraham, who died? He died a long time ago, and the prophets died. Who do you make yourself out to be? There's that question again. The whole theme of the whole gospel. And this question keeps coming up. I haven't been counting. I don't know if any of you have. This has got to be, I don't know, the eighth or tenth time that this question of who you are, who is Jesus? That's the whole theme and point of the Gospel of John. Who is Jesus? So, who do you make yourself out to be? Jesus answered, if I glorify myself, my glory is nothing. It is my Father who glorifies me, of whom you say, he is our God. Now, first of all, just on a side note, that's a true statement. I remember hearing someone famous once say, should I mention his name? It was Ronald Reagan. And I remember somebody saying, I think he was running for re-election, and saying, well, why don't you explain all the good things you've done and talk about how what your accomplishments have been? And he declined to do that. He said, I don't need to talk about my accomplishments. That's for other people to do. It's very unusual for a politician. Because on both sides, on all forms of it, what is typical of a politician? You brag about yourself. Jesus is declining to do that. I'm not going to give glory to myself. It's my Father who glorifies me. I kind of learned something from that. From Jesus, really. Not from Ronald Reagan. From Jesus. You don't brag about yourself, okay? That's not the point. Alright, of whom you say he is our God. But you have not known him. I know him. If I were to say that I do not know him, I would be a liar like you. But I do know him and I keep his word. So again, right there, he's saying, I'm telling the truth. I can't say that I don't know God. Because then I would be lying. Did I offend you?
I didn't want to say anything, but...
Okay. For anybody listening, Phil just left. All right. So, he's basically saying, yes, I have to tell the truth, and the truth is, I know God. I came from God. Your father Abraham rejoiced that he would see my day. He saw it and was glad. Verse 56, we're in there. Abraham saw Jesus? What does he mean, Abraham saw Jesus? What is Jesus referring to there? The Jews, again, are stuck in the literal. That Abraham actually saw you, or you saw him. What are you talking about, Jesus? You are not yet 50 years old, and have you seen Abraham? But what is Jesus talking about? Abraham rejoiced that he would see my day.
The Messiah.
Abraham believed in the coming Messiah. So Jesus is talking here again about the faith of Abraham, recognizing that he would, that the Messiah was coming, that the Messiah would be there. Abraham was saved by faith in the Messiah. You guys have heard this before. The Old Testament people were saved by faith in Jesus, just like we are. They didn't know his name. They didn't know when he would be born. They didn't know some of his teachings and events. But they believed in the future Messiah, and that's what saved them, just like we believe in the Messiah who has come. Now, all of this, who was not here last week? There's a few of you, at least. Because Jill was here, I think, wasn't she? Didn't she show that picture we saw in Israel?
Yeah, she brought that up.
I'm going to show that again.
I did not show that to my Wednesday class, so because I didn't have it. Jill sent it to me again. So I'm going to show that again now, because I'm going to show it tomorrow in Wednesday class at this kind of same point. So here it is, a picture of that we saw in Israel. Okay? Can you kind of see that there? Mm-hmm. Written in Hebrew. And we saw that a few places. And this is what it says in Hebrew. It says, the 120th year of the Rabbi Messiah King. We are doing good for you, and people are being redeemed soon. The Rabbi loves you and will help you. Ask and receive. The time of redemption has come. Long live our Lord, our teacher, and our Rabbi, the King Messiah, forever and ever. Apparently they think it's that guy.
They think he's 120 years old?
No, I think he lived 120 years prior to this. He must have died at some point in there, and now they're still extolling his virtues and praising him as the Messiah.
So he's not alone.
No. I don't believe so. I don't know for sure. My Hebrew is really bad, so I don't know. But of course, the reason I bring that up is because it's not just the Jews of today. It's the Jews at the time of Jesus. They missed the Messiah. What does the Old Testament point to? It points to Jesus as the Messiah. So if you understand the Old Testament, you're going to recognize that Jesus is the Messiah. And, you know, St. Paul, who wrote so much in the New Testament, he lamented that so many of his fellow Jews rejected the true Messiah, Jesus. Now, I know I often have, usually when a comment is made like this, oh, Pastor, what about all those Jews? I said, well, keep in mind, a lot of them are saved, because all the first Christians were Jews, and their descendants, many of them, remained in the faith. And there are Jews today who believe in Jesus, Jews for Jesus. Now, it's a slim chunk of modern-day Judaism, but there are Jews who are maybe ethnically Jewish, but they are Christian by religion. So, yes, Jesus is talking about Abraham seeing in faith the future Messiah come. And they say, you are not yet 50 years old, and have you seen Abraham? What's that reference, 50 years old, mean?
Can't be a priest anymore.
Yeah, I'm surprised you know that. Very good. You priests and Levites had to serve from age 30 to 50. So you couldn't serve until you were 30. Now, if you remember a little bit of your cultural history from Bible times, like Joseph probably was in his early 20s when he married Mary, and she probably was in her mid-teens. That was common. And so once you would get married, a man would have to be a little bit older because he'd have to establish himself in some kind of vocation so he could support a family. And then once you got married, of course, it was expected, much to the delight of grandparents, that you would soon have kids if you could. Not always could. And so by the time that a man was 30, supposedly he would be established. Family, taking care of his family, whatever kids might have come. And so now he should have time to serve in the temple as a priest, or if you're from the tribe of Levi, as a Levite. And that would only go until you're 50. Once you're 50, that was the end of it. Now, this is from the Old Testament. There was a Levitical law about that. So, upon reading this, what do you think is going through my mind?
You're ready to retire?
Yes! Thank you. You nailed it. Exactly. I'm reading this and I'm like, 50?
Yeah.
Well, I just turned 56. I'm 6 years past retirement. So I guess I gotta start to... No, didn't miss it. I'm going to go back and retroactively retire 6 years ago.
Haven't you figured out that pastors don't ever retire?
No, I haven't figured that out.
Look around.
No. La, 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 la. I don't hear that. So, yes, this is probably a reference from the Jews to say, you know, you're not even up to the age of retirement. You're not even up to the age of retirement. And you claim you have seen Abraham? By the way, there is another thought that popped into my head.
when I read this. Because, yes, the age of service in the temple was 30 to 50. How old was Jesus when he started ministry?
30.
Yeah. Think there might be a connection there? I think there might be. Yeah, he died at 33. Right, exactly right.
Quick question. So Zechariah, John the Baptist's dad, had to be under 50 or under, right?
Yeah. Right. So, yeah, you're right. He must have been like late 40s, you know, something like that. And then his wife would be some handful of years younger.
I must remember my Sunday school pictures and children's Bibles where he looked like he was like 100.
Yes, gray hair, long beard, whatever. That would not have been accurate for Zechariah. Yeah, he would have been middle-aged, probably 40-something, late 40s, yeah. Yep. All right. Jesus said to them, "Truly, truly, I say to you, before Abraham was, I am." So here's another one of those I am statements. I think there's 16 of them, I think, in the Gospel of John, and here's one of them. And this is one that we call an absolute, because it's not Jesus saying, "I am the good shepherd, I am the bread of life." He just says, "I am." And in the Greek, that's another case of the ego I me that we've talked about so much. Jesus says, "I am." And they know he's referring to the name Yahweh, the Greek translation of the Hebrew name Yahweh. So it's very clear here, Jesus is calling himself God. Okay? So, of course, they would be completely upset at that. You know, the Jesus keeps hinting at, and sometimes in a vague way, and here not so vague, that he is God, and he keeps using the I am statement, ego I me, and boy, they're getting more and more riled up, and here it's as plain as can be. So they pick up stones to throw at him. Well, that would have gotten them in trouble with the Romans, right? You guys all know, why did they take Jesus to Pontius Pilate when he was arrested? If you have problems with him, go and execute him yourself. And what did they respond? We're not allowed to. It has to come through the Roman government. For all of the ills and problems of the Roman government, that is probably one good rule that they had, law that they had, that you're not allowed to seek vengeance, you know, vigilantism on each other. If you want a death sentence on somebody, it's got to go through the Roman government. That was probably a good thing.
Stab them yourself.
Yeah, you can't just stab them yourself, right, exactly.
No, or you just go stab them.
Oh, yeah. In the dead of the night, sneak in and...
No, right, yeah.
Well, sometimes they did that. Yeah, there was the assassins. Yeah, there were the assassins that would go around and knife somebody. That's true.
It could be, too, that by the time it got to the crucifixion, they hated him so much they wanted him to die in a gruesome way, not just stone him to death, because they did stone Stephen.
I think you're right. So obviously the Romans would occasionally look the other way for somebody breaking their law, that you can't execute capital punishment without us, because they stoned Stephen, and you know, we don't know that anything happened from that or not. But yes, you're right. It might be that they just wanted Jesus to have the shame of crucifixion and the horror and pain of crucifixion. They wanted to inflict upon him the worst death possible. Yeah, I think you're right, Rich. That's a good point.
You know, I read that the other day on Wikipedia. I think it was Wikipedia. The explanation of crucifixion and that. And it's too gory. I couldn't even read it all. When we're talking about it's the most painful death that man ever came up with. And
yeah.
And the Romans excelled at it. They improved it so it'd be more painful.
More problem. Yeah, worse. They improved it to make it worse.
Yes.
Yeah.
I think they too wanted the people to believe that they didn't kill Jesus.
Mm-hmm.
The Roman government did, you know.
So the Jewish leaders at that time were maybe trying to pass the buck. That could be part of it too. Absolutely.
Another washing of
this
hands,
is all good fodder for my upcoming Good Friday sermon. I gotta start writing that in a few weeks. Yeah, very good. Thank you. Good thing it's recorded. So if you hear echoes of your voices in the future sermon, you'll know why. All right, now this last little bit here is kind of interesting. They picked up stones to throw at him, but Jesus did what?
Hid
himself and went out of the temple. How many times has this happened? Does it mean Jesus just, like, disappeared?
what's the, is that genie that would do that? I don't know what she, oh, wiggle her nose or something?
That
I don't
was Samantha.
Yeah, okay. I dream, oh, it's Samantha, okay.
Yeah, that
no. No, it would just be that Jesus would, I mean, maybe there was a little divine essence going on there, but, you know, he could just kind of hide himself in the crowd and disappear. You know, you could do that. And so all of a sudden they couldn't see him. They couldn't find him. They, maybe in the act, and actually this is from Dr. Weinrich, that maybe in the act of them going to find some stones, they come back, where'd he go? I can't see him.
And
you know?
It says in the Bible that there was nothing remarkable about him.
Right.
Physically, so.
He would blend in with the crowd.
It's like if you go to a fly fishing event, and it's all guys that look like Dad, and you couldn't pick, well, it also reminds me, I went to pick up my Aunt Christy at LWML conference in Portland when I lived out there, and I am pulling up to the big conference center with thousands of women, and she says to me, I've let my hair go gray, I'm wearing khaki capris and a denim shirt like a jacket, and I get out of my car, and there are 7,000 women, middle-aged, gray hair, khaki capris, and a blue denim shirt like a jacket, and I just sat and laughed and laughed, and I sat down on a park bench and waited.
Sure.
So, you got, well, yeah.
Sure.
But, you know, there's middle-aged man with a beard hanging out near the temple.
Yeah. Right. Yeah, no, good illustration. That's a good point. Absolutely. So Jesus could just blend in with the crowd and kind of melt away. He knew what does it say elsewhere in John? His hour had not yet come. Now the reason this is interesting is because this is about to launch us into the next event. If some of you go forward in your Bible to chapter 9, what is chapter 9 about?
A blind man
who could see, who was given sight. Let me scroll down on it a little bit. Sorry, here. Right there. Jesus heals a man born blind. We will get into that next week and the week after. And it's interesting that a blind man sees who Jesus is, while the Jewish leaders who can see with their eyes cannot see who Jesus is. Do you see the reversal, the irony there? So this is, again, some of the brilliance of John, the apostle who wrote this. He's setting up these events. He's telling them that there might have been some stuff that happened in between here, but the next event he tells us about is Jesus healing a man born blind right after the Jews can't see who Jesus is. I love it. It's just awesome. Wow, God's word is wonderful.
Figuratively and literally.
Exactly. By the way, Elliot was telling our family tonight at dinner about he's been accused at college of Midwestern grammar. That apparently we end our sentences with prepositions, which you're not supposed to do. If any of you know that. And he said, boy, there's a lot of grammar Nazis at college. So, yes.
College,
and the reason I bring this up is because one place, what'd you say?
College at,
right. Yeah. L. Isaac says, what do you mean we finish with prepositions? He said, oh, we say things like, well, where are you at? Where are you going to? He said, we say that all the time, and that's not what you're supposed to say. So there's this whole debate at our dinner table tonight. You'd be amazed what we talk about at dinner.
There is some evidence in linguistic study right now that is changing. It's actually changing in our language and becoming
more acceptable.
More acceptable that our language is changing, even in written.
The reason I bring this up, because a personal grammar annoyance of mine is people who say literally in the wrong spot or in the wrong way. Oh, literally, I just died when I heard that. No, you didn't literally die, because you're standing here telling me. You figuratively died, so you don't say that. That annoys me, and I hear that in movies and on the newscasts and radio shows all the time. So there's my grammar Nazi, you know, bone to pick with people, but anyway.
You used it correctly.
You did use it correctly, and so I'm complimenting you is really what I'm doing, kind of in an extended way.
I was one of the grammar
There you go.
My grad school class. They always look to us.
Yeah, there you go.
Gale.
So yes, you used it correctly. Thank you. All right. Any final questions or comments? All right. Wow. Well, okay. All right. Next week, chapter 9. So we'll get started on that. So let's rise and close with the Lord's Prayer. Our Father,
who art in heaven, hallowed be thy name. Thy kingdom come, thy will be done, on earth as it is in heaven. Give us this day our daily bread, and forgive us our trespasses, as we forgive those who trespass against us. And lead us not into temptation, but deliver us from evil. For thine is the kingdom, and the power, and the glory, forever and ever. Amen.
Thanks for coming. Have a good night.
Is everybody wearing their purple bracelets?